how I spent last week. And how I spent last week is this. I had signed up for and was going to attend this, you know, like weeks ago, months ago. I was going to attend a retreat with a teacher I've sat with before and who I've learned a lot from and who has been really enriching for me, both as a yogi and also as a teacher, Venerable Anaglio, a German monk who is really wonderful and skillful English language translator of the very early Pali texts, the very earliest teachings of the Buddha. And he had been going to offer a retreat on, the title of it was The Brahma Viharas and Emptiness. And as we know, the Brahma Viharas are the Buddha's teachings on the cultivation of loving kindness and compassion and selfless joy and equanimity. And the title of the retreat was The Brahma Viharas and Emptiness. And emptiness is the Buddha's teachings on...
Turn this off.
Hello? Okay. The Buddha's teachings on emptiness are the teachings on not self, which is to say, the very radical idea at the time, 2,500 years ago, which continues to be a pretty radical idea now, actually, which is that this notion of self or personhood that we take to be, or that we're trained to be or taught to be, taking on as the way things are or who we are, is actually a kind of a fiction. And that the self is not something that's existentially existent, but rather something that the mind creates. And so when the Buddha would be challenged philosophically when he began to teach, and they would say, well, is there a self or is there not a self? It's got to be one or the other. He wouldn't respond at all to that challenge. And then whoever made the challenge would go away, and somebody would ask him, well, why didn't you answer the question? Is there a self or is there not a self? And he said, I didn't answer the question because of the way that it was asked. If somebody asks that question, it means that they want to hear one answer or the other. The answer that they were not capable of hearing is that the self cannot be said to exist, nor can the self be said to not exist. The self exists when the mind creates the self, and the self does not exist when the mind does not create the self. But the idea that the self is a conjuring, is a construct of the mind itself, is something that people really couldn't get their head around at the time, and that continues to be a pretty difficult one for today. And so one of the things that really intrigued me or attracted me to this retreat is it's a question I come around to, come back at again and again. And at various times in my own practice, I've been able to answer it satisfactorily for myself, but there remains this part that said, okay, this is a question worth taking deeper. And so I was really looking forward to doing that on this retreat, because he was teaching about how does one cultivate these mind states, you know, the Brahma Viharas, and yet at the same time, the teaching that there is no one doing the cultivating. And so how does that happen? So I was really keen on doing the retreat and was making travel plans to go out to California. It was going to be held at a retreat. And then as the retreat time grew nearer, the CV-19 contagion continued to become more serious and more challenging. And one of the epicenters for CV-19 in California is in fact the Bay Area. And the highest number of cases was in Santa Clara County, which is just on the other side of the mountains from where the retreat center is. And so they decided they were going to have to cancel the retreat and that they were going to instead hold it through video conferencing, like what we're doing this evening. And so that was both bad news and good news. On the one hand, it meant I wasn't going to be able to attend the retreat and sit with this teacher who I've really grown fond of and learned a lot from. And on the other hand, since it was going to be video streamed into our home, my wife Abby and I were kind of happy that she was going to be able to attend as well. And so the week before the retreat, we did a lot of grocery shopping or had it done for us. And we planned menus, and we set up our living room as a Dharma hall with an altar and our sitting stuff, and we're all rip-roaring ready to go. And the day before the retreat, we got word that the retreat had been canceled. And the reason for that was because once it became necessary to offer the retreat in video conference format, Bhante and Alio had set to work on doing everything possible to convert all these teachings and all these instructions that he'd put together for a face-to-face retreat into video conference format. And coming up on the beginning of the retreat, he realized that it wasn't coming together in a way that he thought was both equal to the teachings he wanted to present and his ability to teach them well. And so he canceled the retreat. And that really kind of left us hanging. And so Abby and I discussed what to do. And we decided we wanted to go ahead and hold our own self-retreat at home during that week anyway, because we already had the food, we'd already told our friends and family that we were going to be in silence. And so what we did was to put together a retreat schedule for ourselves, kind of like you would, you know, the schedule you'd see on a in any residential retreat. And Abby recently been on the 3-month retreat at IMS, and so she pulled down some morning instruction talks and some evening Dharma talks so that we would be able to benefit from those from people like Carol Wilson and Guy Armstrong and Jill Shepherd and whatnot. And we went ahead and held a self-retreat here at home. And it turned out to be really powerful. The talks that she chosen were similar to, related to the themes that were going to be focused on by Bhante and this retreat on cultivation and emptiness. And it was quite a remarkable experience. There was very deep samadhi that happened. There was the development of understanding. And we really got a lot out of it. I reread Guy Armstrong's book on emptiness, and so a lot of what I was hoping to get out of the retreat sitting with Analio, we actually generated for ourselves. And during the course of our time on retreat, I began to think about, okay, well, you know, what we've done here is to assemble teachings on these two topics to help deepen our own understanding and our approach to practice and whatnot. And what if I were to give a talk on these themes, on the relationship between how we go about cultivating wholesome mind states, like the Brahma Viharas and, you know, the factors of enlightenment and all that good stuff, when in fact, according to these teachings, there isn't really any one, any self, doing all this cultivating. And so that's what I did. So I, after our self-retreat was over, I sat down and started working on a talk that included bringing those two things together. And I wrote and wrote and wrote and did some reading and wrote some more. And eventually wound up with about 10 pages of notes. And I realized, wow, that's a whole lot to try to cram into one Dharma talk. So I decided that what I would like to do instead was to spend some time together this evening where I kind of go over sort of the high points or some of the core teachings across this range of topics, and offer it as a kind of an overview. And then during our future times together on Sunday nights, and I plan to be doing more Sunday night teaching in the future than I have in the past, where we can explore a little more deeply what the Buddha had to say on some of these topics. So that's what we're going to do. Now, the Buddha used different metaphors, and metaphor means a kind of a big picture comparison, like the what we're doing when we practice Buddha Dharma and study Buddha Dharma is like, you know, one of the is like metaphors that he used was cultivation. So, for instance, we as a species, as human beings, as Homo sapiens, came into being about 200,000 years ago. One of the things that made that possible, one of the things that made it possible for us to survive and thrive over the last 200,000 years was our collective wisdom and our knowledge and our collective ability to go out into the field and to discern which plants and animals were wholesome and nutritious sources of food that would keep us alive, and which ones were poisonous and might kill us. And so, happily, most of the things that were nutritious and good for us tasted good, and most of the things that were bad and poisonous tasted bad, except not always. So there were some things that were good for us that we had to mess with or cook or kind of process a little bit in order for us to get the goods out of them. And there were some things that tasted good, that were attractive and that we liked to eat, except we noticed that those around us who ate and enjoyed those things then fell over and died. And so over time, we came to realize these things are poisonous. These things are really bad for us and we shouldn't eat them. And so over thousands and thousands of years, that knowledge got passed down. What is wholesome and nutritious? What should we be consuming and what should we be not consuming? About 10,000 years ago in Mesopotamia, about 20,000 years ago in South America, there was this great big shift in human societies when we move from being mostly hunter-gatherer cultures and became more agriculture-based cultures. And in fact, the word culture came from how one generation teaches the next how to sustain itself, how to learn what is good for us and what is not. And so that inherited skill passed down over all those millennia, the Buddha said, was exactly the same one that we need to use in terms of what not only the body ingests, but what the mind ingests, what kind of mind states arise. And the suggestions they make to us and the way they cause us to look at the world, which of those are wholesome and which of those are poisonous. The ones that he said are poisonous, whether they taste nasty from the get-go or whether they actually taste and feel kind of good, but it turns out later they're not, he actually called the kilesas, the poisons of the mind, greed, hate, and delusion. The ones that he considered to be beneficial, that if nourished and sustained, okay, that were worthy of development, you know, were things like the Brahma Viharas, like the cultivation of wisdom, the cultivation of compassion, the cultivation of peace of mind, the cultivation of selfless joy. So what he was literally saying is that the skills that we inherited as human beings and as human societies that made it possible for us to be here today, insofar as how we nourish the body, are not different from those that lead to the liberation from self-inflicted suffering. And just like over the millennia, we learn to trust that knowledge. He's saying, so too, can you trust these teachings to help you move forward and to nourish yourself spiritually and to avoid harming yourself spiritually. So the metaphor of cultivation. The interesting thing, I think, about the two dominant metaphors of the Buddha's teaching over the course of his life, one of them was cultivation. And so I just talked about human society's conversion from hunting and gathering over to agricultural lifestyle, and the Buddha lived in an agricultural culture. You know, he lived in a time when agriculture was the dominant means of human sustenance. And yet, at the same time, the other metaphor that he mostly relied upon was that of being on a path, the Eightfold Path, the means of attaining self-realization, attaining freedom. And that involves movement. It involves being on a journey. It involves a continuous step-by-step process of self-realization. So in some ways, when I think about it, it's like the Buddha's describing where we were at that crossroads 20,000 years ago, when we were trying to figure out whether to be hunter-gatherers or whether we're going to start being agriculturalists instead. And so what the Buddha seems to be telling us through the use of both of those kinds of metaphors is that, in fact, we're both. You know, that as we go forth on this journey, we are, in fact, hunters and gatherers. And yet, at the same time, we still need to have these skills or this ability to discern what we should be cultivating and what we should be avoiding. So, there are these two metaphors that the Buddha used. Okay, and within the metaphors, he also used similes. And so metaphors are about a big picture, about creating an entire worldview about how things work. Similes are more constrained, and they happen within metaphors. They're about how is this similar to that. So for instance, in the Buddha's metaphor of being on the path, being on the Eightfold Path, okay? Um, within that metaphor of continuous spiritual growth and evolution and development, among the metaphors that he used was, for instance, the simile of the snake. So in the simile of the snake, he said, as we go forth, as we grow and develop and mature on the path, what we are doing is similar to what a snake does when it periodically sheds its skin. That every year or two or whatever, a serpent will shed the skin that it has grown in order to protect itself and make its way through the world, because the snake is continuing to grow and it outgrows the skin, the protective cover around it. And so when the time comes, it sheds that skin and it grows another one. And then it inhabits that skin and makes its way through the world until it's outgrown that one. And then it sheds that and grows another. And so that's the assembly for spiritual growth within this metaphor of being on the path toward realization. Another one that has, I guess, particularly appeal or resonance for me, because one of my default settings, one of my inclinations of the mind is toward, or can be, it tends toward self-aversion. The Buddha said self-aversion is like a dog with a collar around its neck chained to a post, and the dog is continuously lunging against the chain, trying to get free of the post. And as it does so, all it really does is to hurt its neck. That the effort to get away from its entanglement, its incarceration, okay, only hurts it more. And that the way that one stops doing that is to stop being the dog and stop being the post and stop being the collar and stop being the chain. And so this is another simile for how self-inflicted suffering keeps us from getting where we want to go. So similes and metaphors, and the ways that he sought to use them in his teaching to help us see where he was trying to take us and how this liberation comes about. And then what Anālaya was aiming toward in his retreat, and what's been on my mind as well during this time, is okay, so there's all this effort that we're being encouraged to expend on cultivation, seeking out the wholesome, recognizing the wholesome and cultivating it, recognizing the unwholesome and starving on not giving it energy. Okay. The effort and the of being on a path of moving towards that which liberates us and not being deflected by that which constrains us or entraps us. But who is doing the cultivating? And that's where the Buddha's teachings on emptiness come in. If indeed there is no self, who is doing the cultivating? Who is on the path if there is no self making all these decisions? And the Buddha, soon after he began to teach, was confronted with that question. And he was confronted with it over and over and over again. And he had to sort of come to terms with it. And he had to decide how he was going to convey to others his own understanding of how this movement toward freedom happened, if it was not happening as the result of some self, some decision maker, some decider directing us in that direction. How can these things occur if they are not controlled by the self? So he posited a different kind of a guidance system. And what he taught was that there is a means by which the mind knows where it needs to go to achieve liberation. It is quite apart from the functions of the self. Okay. It is quite apart from how the self-created view thinks that things ought to be or decides what it thinks ought to be done. And what he said was that this alternative means of guiding ourselves towards freedom lies within the Eightfold Path. That in fact, it's the wisdom factors, the factors that allow us to, you know, after the mind has become calm through meditative practice, that there are these factors that develop in the Eightfold Path, the what's sometimes called wise view or wise understanding. It's basically insight into our own karma, into our own past, that allows us to look back with compassion at all the causes and conditions that gave rise to who we are up until the present moment, all the decisions that we've made and actions that we've taken that have resulted in beneficial outcomes, all the decisions that we've taken, things we've said that have resulted in unfortunate or unwholesome ones, and why those happened, our ability to look at the causes and conditions that caused us to be who we are in the moment. Right? So the better insight we have into why we are who we are up until the present moment is a really rich source of insight into who we might be in the next moment, which is the other wisdom factor. The wisdom factor of wise intention. So as we are confronted with any kind of decision situation in the moment, we have this alternative guidance system that presents to us, okay, this is how we came to be who we are in the moment. These are the wholesome and unwholesome intentions that are arising in our consciousness right now, that are begging for us to empower them to do or not do, to say or not say a certain thing in the future. Which ones am I going to listen to? Which ones am I going to empower? And so that's the means by which we decide sort of where to go from here. So how does all this actually work in practice? Well, about almost 1,000 years after the Buddha lived and taught and died, and his teachings began to be written down. On the island of Sri Lanka, there was a there were several communities of monastics who were practicing the Buddha's original teachings, and these eventually got written down into a kind of a user's guide to the Pali Canon by a cleric, a monk named Buddhaghosa, in an ancient commentary called the Visuddhimagga. And he was trying to find his own simile for describing how this guidance system worked, I guess what he would call spiritual intuition. What is it that informs us how we should make our way along the path? And what the simile that he used, and I thought this is only something that British sailors came up with in the, you know, 17th century, but it turns out that way back about 500 years into the Common Era, the sailors out in the Indian Ocean were already doing this, which is, and this is before they had reliable compasses and were just starting to figure out how to navigate by the stars and the sun. But most of the commercial sailing was done in the Indian Ocean was done more or less along coastlines and near coastlines from one port to the next. But occasionally when these trading ships were out in the Indian Ocean, they get caught in a big storm and get blown way out to sea someplace, and they had no idea where they were. And so what they did as a way to try to get around that was to come up with, you know, a very early primitive version of sort of radar. And so what they would do is they would take a cage full of crows along with them when they went out to sea. Really bad news for the crows, because the crows are land birds and they hate the water and they don't like to be on the water and they don't like to be at sea. But that was exactly why the sailors would take them along. And they were up in the topmost, at the top of the tallest mast on the sailing ship. They would create a little place that was called a crow's nest. And so if they got blown way out to sea and they had no idea where they were, every morning one of the sailors would take one of these crows out of the cage and they'd climb up the mast and put it in the crow's nest. The crow had no interest in staying on the ship at all. And so the first thing they'd do would be to fly off. And it would fly up as high as it could, and it would fly all around and look and sniff and see if it could find land anywhere. And if it couldn't, it would eventually come back down and land in the crow's nest on the ship. And then after a while, the sailor would release it again. It would go out and look around again. And when it couldn't find or see, smell any land, it would just come back to the ship and they would take it back down into the hold. And they'd do this every day as they were trying to find their way, until eventually someday they'd release a crow, would fly high up into the air, fly around, and it would see land or smell land, whatever. And when the crow did that, instead of coming back down to the ship, it would start off for the land. And it would, you know, they'd say as the crow flies, unlike some other birds, crows don't swoop and glide and whatnot. They fly in a really straight line exactly where they want to go. And so once they released the crow and they could see it flying in a straight line, they knew it was flying to land. And so they would orient the ship's course until it was following the crow. And they'd follow the crow until it was completely out of sight. And they'd bring another crow up and do the same thing. And it would take off and it would go straight toward land. And so what Buddhaghosa said is that when the Buddha was teaching about spiritual wisdom and its ability to inform us about how we ought to practice, and how we ought to heed our own spiritual intuition. He said, it's just the same thing. It's like this homing instinct. There's something in us that knows where we want to go and that knows how we ought to get there. And that what we need to do is to learn how to trust that, learn how to listen to it, and learn how to sort of let it be our guide. And I think that's a pretty useful teaching. Bringing that simile forward into the present day, I was reminded of a really tragic air accident that happened in June of 2009. And it was an Air France flight from Rio de Janeiro to Paris. And they got caught in a storm and hugely turbulent air over the Atlantic Ocean. And in the course of them getting caught up in this storm, the devices on the plane's exterior that measure airspeed got frozen up. And so the pilots no longer had any idea of how fast the airplane was going. Freezing up of that instrument did was to also disengage automatic pilot. And the way airplanes fly, over long distances these days is that, we talk about, well, maybe someday there's going to be self-driving cars. There already are self-flying airplanes, and they've been around for quite a while now. So essentially, pilots of aircraft, commercial aircraft, they have control of the airplane when they're taking off, so they can get out of crowded airspace and up into their flight path and cruising altitude. And they take control of the airplane when they're landing. So again, they can make sure that they don't run anybody else. But almost all the rest of the time the aircraft is in the air, it's actually being flown by computers. That everything having to do with the path of the aircraft, the speed of it, its rate of ascent, its rate of descent, is all programmed in. And so mostly what the pilots do for most of a flight is simply to look at an array of computer screens and of instruments. And so what happened on this particular flight was that the external sensors froze up, and that disengaged the automatic pilot, and some of the instruments they relied upon, some of the computer screens they relied upon, went dark. And suddenly the pilots were supposed to take manual control of the airplane without a lot of the data that they usually relied upon to fly it. And in this particular flight, there were three pilots because it was a long flight and they needed to be able to relieve each other. One pilot was near 60 years old, a captain, and he was taking a nap. The youngest pilot, who was half his age, was at the controls. And when he lost his instruments, he started making decisions that turned out to prove fatal. He didn't know what the angle of the aircraft was. He didn't know whether they're going left or right. And so he made some decisions that took the plane into a really steep climb that eventually became so steep that the airplane fell out of the air. And when the senior pilot was awakened and brought up there, he realized that they were in a tailspin and there were actions the junior pilot needed to take to pull it out. But by the time he started trying to give the junior pilot the instructions, it was too late. And so after the crash happened and there was discussion about what had happened in the cockpit, some of the senior pilots in the aviation industry said, well, you know, the junior pilots were really good at flying their instruments and they're really good at flying their computer screens. They didn't know how to fly the airplane. And that's because in the old days, there was a lot more time spent training pilots to feel the airplane, even when their instruments weren't working, to know kind of what was going on. And the junior pilot didn't have that sense. You know, my dad was a Navy pilot in World War II in the Pacific, and he was the captain of a heavily armed patrol plane. And he told me that when they were getting instrument training, they would, the way they did that was to cover the windshield with a blanket so they couldn't see outside, and they only had to rely on their instruments to figure out where they were and how to land the airplane and whatnot. But he said the other thing they trained them to do, instead of covering the windshield, they covered the instrument panel. And so the pilots had to learn how the airplane was handling, whether it was on the level or not, how to do diving turns and climbing at an angle and a climbing turn, just by how the plane felt and how the engine sounded in terms of how fast they were going. He said it was called learning to fly by the seat of your pants. And then he told me that training probably saved his life and that of his crew, because the pilot was, they're out, the plane was out on patrol one day in the South Pacific, looking for, you know, Japanese ships and whatnot. And they were attacked by a Japanese fighter, a Zero. And so fighters, when they're attacking a plane like his, a big multi-engine plane, they first aim for the cockpit to see if they can kill the pilots, and then they'll come around and shoot up the engines as a way to bring down the aircraft. And so this fighter came down at them from a high angle in front, shot up the cockpit, killed his co-pilot, shot up all the instruments, and shot up the plane, and then was making a second pass to take out the engines, but the gunners on my father's plane shot up the fighter and drove it off. So they were about 400 miles from this teeny island where they were based out in the middle of the Pacific, and he didn't have any instruments, didn't have a co-pilot anymore. But he could see, you know, he could see the horizon, and his navigator was still alive. And the navigator had a working compass and he had his charts. And so he said what he did was that he had to fly these 400 miles just by feeling the airplane and how it was handling, even though it wasn't handling right because it was shot up. And he had the voice of his navigator over the intercom, and the navigator would tell him, steer to port, steer to starboard, you know, just keeping him on course until they attained visual contact with their island and he was able to land the plane. So the reason I tell that story, that particular simile, is to say, we're all flying by the seat of our pants. The reason that Flight 447 crashed is because the pilots didn't know how to fly the airplane. They weren't able to become one with the aircraft they were part of. You know? So we have begun to become sensorially part of who we are in the moment in a way that a lot of people aren't. And there's the voice of the navigator that's saying, okay, steer right, steer left. So that's one simile that has some meaning for me. Another is when I was in the Navy, I had an opportunity to learn how to sail a sailboat. And so in San Diego Harbor, when I was stationed there, and so there are these little 15-foot sloops that we learned to sail on and take out. And the difference between like being in a motorboat or a ship and being in a sailboat is that on a motorboat, you're kind of on the water. It's sort of like driving a car on the water. In a sailboat, you're in the water. You're down there. You can, most of the hull of the boat is actually far below the waterline, so you can feel it. You can feel what it's like. You can feel the currents. You can feel the wind and the sails, and your body kind of becomes part of the boat, you know. In the Denver Sangha, there's a member who's what we call a blue water sailor, which is somebody who sails big sailboats that go out into the open ocean and sail from here to Hawaii or from, you know, Florida to the Azores or South Africa. And he said, what he told me was that, you know, even on these big boats, these 50-foot, you know, schooners and whatnot that go far out to sea, they have their own little weather stations, and they have sonar, and they have depth finders, and they have GPS navigation. But he said, still far and away, the most important instrument on the boat is the sailor, because the sailor can feel the boat. The sailor knows what the wind is doing. The sailor knows what the currents are doing. And he told me that when he realized that he had finally begun to master what it means to be a blue water sailor, he said that after he'd gotten this pretty big boat and was taking it out and was trying to, so he struggled to make it do what he wanted it to do in terms of direction and the pitch and all of the things that he thought the boat ought to do in order to get him where he wanted to go, that he was struggling, and he never felt like he really quite got the hang of it, and he was discouraged, and he was starting to doubt himself as to whether or not he was going to be able to learn how to master such a big craft. And he said at some point, when he realized he really wasn't getting the hang of it, he just surrendered and let go. And then he realized that the boat was actually trying to tell him how to sail it. And that he really began to listen to and feel what the boat was doing. And that once he had that kind of cooperative relationship with it, that he really began to sense what it was capable of. And once he learned to trust the boat, he began to be able to trust his own skill at sailing as well. When I was a kid, growing up in the mountains outside of Tucson, Arizona, we had horses, and the cowboy that sold us our horses and built our corral and whatnot, I wanted to learn how to ride. And so my dad was saying, well, what kind of saddle should we get him and whatnot? And what Bill said was, well, you know, if you really want your kid to learn how to ride a horse, don't get him a saddle. he needs to learn how to ride bareback. And so I did. I never got a saddle because I learned that riding a horse was not a matter of telling the horse where you wanted to go and making him do it. It was a matter of negotiation. It was a matter of partnership, you know, of getting the feel of the horse and the realizing that you were in a goat negotiation. And the horse said, well, you know, I'm happy to pretend that you're the boss, as long as you don't do anything dangerous or stupid or mean, in which case we're going to have to renegotiate, you know. And learning to become an extension of the horse, learning to learn from the horse, it's really an important part of learn to be a decent horseman. Just like our friend in the Sangha said, learning to trust the boat was the secret to becoming a decent sailor. Bringing it all back around to us, Buddhaghosa's teaching about the crow and following that instinct. There are a lot of, especially migratory waterfowl bird species that do the same thing. When I was living in New Zealand a few years ago, I learned about the Australasian gannet, which is a bird that it's like a big seagull, kind of, except it's more streamlined, and instead of a hooked beak, it has one that looks like the tip of a javelin. And the way it makes its living is by diving vertically into the ocean, spearing fish. And in New Zealand, a big colony of them live on Mirawai Beach, which is on the west coast of the North Island. And every year they make a migration from the cliffside habitat where all their nests are. They fly about 1,500 miles southwest across the Tasman Sea to southeastern Australia. And they live there for several months, and they chow down on the fish in the ocean near the shore. And then when it comes time to go back to their colony, their nests in New Zealand, first the males leave and they fly back to the colony and they do guy stuff. They fight about real estate and whatnot, and they figure out who's going to claim which nests and whatnot. And then a couple of weeks later, all the adult females leave and they fly back across the Tasman Sea, and they set up housekeeping, and set up a house with the males who've staked out the territory. And what's left is all the yearlings, all the birds that have just flown, made this flight for the first time in their lives. And they spend about another couple of 3 weeks hanging out in southeastern Australia. There are no adults among them at all. And then on some given day, after they've finished gorging on fish and whatnot, they all form up and they take off in formation. And they fly back across the Tasman Sea on a course that they've never flown before. And yet, even though they may get blown off course by strong winds or storms or whatever, they fly right straight back across the Tasman Sea to Mirawai Beach, to the place where they were born. And they all land on the nest where they were born. There's something in their consciousness that allows them to do that. And what the Buddha said is that that kind of homing instinct, and the Tibetans talk about this a lot when they see, when they talk about being on the path, and they are asked, what does it mean to be on the path? Where are you going? And what the Buddhists, what the Tibetans say is that we're going home. We're going back to the place from which we came. We're returning to the primordial light that brought us forth in the first place. And so for me, that particular simile really has a lot of meaning. And when I think about us here together in Sangha, even though we're physically separate, we're still connected in the way that we are, on screen tonight, among the ways I volunteer my time, and happily I'm still able to do it, is as a naturalist at Bar Lake State Park, which is a wildlife preserve about 25 miles northeast of here, off Highway 76 near Brighton. And there are about 350 species of birds out there. And especially in the fall and winter times, right at sunset, there are these flights of Canada geese, flights of maybe 300 to 500 birds at once, and they all come into the area of Bar Lake, and they swirl around, and then they land, and then another flight comes in, and another, and a smaller version of this happens also at City Park Lake in Denver and at Wash Park, but it's particularly dramatic there because there are times when the sky is almost black with these huge flights of these geese, and then they come in and they land on the lake until there are like 2,000 to 3,000 geese there. And as they land, they're making all kinds of racket, and the people who study birds say that essentially what they're doing, first off, is they're taking roll. They're making sure that everybody they took off with has made it there safely. And so they do a roll call, and then they check in with the other flights that are already there. And then in the morning, they do the same thing. They do a roll call, and then they decide where they want to go that day, and then they all take off. I had one of my teachers when I was in my seminary program was a very senior monk named Ajahn Amaro, and we were talking about Sangha. We were talking about the meaning of the word Sangha and the different ways it could be applied. And he said, well, you know, there's such a thing. This, we speak about that term in very narrow connotations, like the Sangha of monks and nuns or the Sangha of enlightened beings or whatnot. But he said, there can be a Sangha of birds. He said, it's like any purposeful connection or collection of members of a group with common purpose. And so when I think about us and the way that Ajahn Amaro talked about Sangha, one of the things that sometimes comes to mind for me is these flights of migratory waterfowl, whether it's the Canada geese or ducks or the grebes or any of the others. It's like we are separate but together, that we are in this formation, in this flight, where we have a sense of common purpose and we have a sense of common direction, and we're there for each other. And so I feel both grateful and in some ways kind of blessed to be part of this gathering, especially as we find ourselves right now flying through some kind of turbulent times. but, you know, just like the Gannets, I have every faith that we are going to find a way both to stay together and to stay on course as we go forward. Looking at the clock, I find that I have waxed a little too eloquent, and we don't really have much time for discussion or anything. So I want to thank you for tuning in and for being part of our flight, our Sangha here together this evening, and for listening to me share these views. And going forward, I plan to do a much better job of time management so we can have more by way of conversation and less of you just watching a talking head. Thank you for being here tonight. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you.
Thank you, Lloyd.
Thank you, Lloyd. Thank you. And Kathleen, thank you.
Lloyd and Kathleen.
Have a safe and healthy week, everybody.
Thanks, Lloyd.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Thank you.